Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives, as we bring you some of our favourite conversations from 2021. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight lives and breathes food and flavours, and through an incredible amount of hard work and dedication to his craft, has become one of Melbourne's most successful and well-recognised chefs. With a work ethic instilled in him by his hard-working Maltese family and a desire to achieve more than was ever expected of him by his high school teachers, he's now considered the maestro of Australia's Middle Eastern food scene and shares his passion for food via his various TV shows. But just don't call him a celebrity chef. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, Shane D'Elia. How are you, Shane?
Well, after an intro like that, I'm pretty good.
It's a good wrap-up of you. Now, first of all, I want to know what irks you about being called a celebrity chef.
I'm not a celebrity. I'm just a cook. I mean, I've been pretty blessed and had some chance to do some media stuff and meet some amazing people. And, you know, I never thought that my ugly head people would want to have a look at on TV, but I don't consider myself a celebrity. I'm just an average guy.
Yeah, but Melburnians love food so much. So someone who can serve them up an incredible dish, I think, is a celebrity in anyone's eyes, whether you're on TV or not.
Well, then all my chefs behind the scenes should be the celebrities, because they're the amazing blokes that are getting it done. I've got a great team of, you know, girls and guys in there that bust their chops every day to get it done. I'm just the guy that takes the credit.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Now, you're back on our TV screens on Channel 9 and SBS, but let's start with Postcards, which is, of course, on Channel 9, Victoria's favourite travel show, as they call it. But this scene is going to be a bit different, isn't it, focusing on inspiring Victorians to get out and support local businesses, communities, and I guess there is no better time, no better year to be doing that, especially in your industry.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been so lucky to be on Postcards. I mean, I've been watching Postcards for so long, and then I was a guest on there a couple of times as a chef, and then to get the call up and come on and be asked to be a presenter was like a dream. I mean, I love it. The best bit about it is that I actually get out to go into the marketplace and meet real Melburnians, real Victorians, and hear their stories and just try to help them get a leg up. And like you said, I mean, this year is so important to support local, but I mean, what we've been able to do with Postcards so far is that we've probably gone to a few little places that aren't the must-go-to, real scenic places. I mean, we got to take the cameras and go back to my old stomping ground of St Albans out in the western suburbs, which, you know, isn't the most picturesque place, but has an amazing wealth of people. And the people there are so beautiful, and they need support just like all the big end-of-town restaurants do.
Absolutely. And do you find yourself still surprised, or is it still an eye-opener to learn, you know, about new dining experiences in your own backyard?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the best thing about Melbourne is that we're resilient here, you know. Like, we really, really do try to stand up in the face of adversity. And, you know, the strength and the belief and the passion of Victorians and Australians as a whole is just really inspiring. So in one hand, yes, I'm surprised to find new things. What really surprises me is when I find those little institutions that I didn't know anything about that might have been there for you know, 20 or 30 years. And it's just like, wow, how did I not know about this place? And, you know, those people, those stories, those smiles, that, you know, that craft is what really inspires me.
Yeah, I love that. As you say, for some people, the local is everything. So that's so good that you could capture that. In one episode of Postcards, you head to Inner West Footscray, and that's a really diverse little pocket of Melbourne. Were you surprised to find that, or would you knew about that already?
Nah, that's my hood. I'm a Westie, so, you know, like
Oh, yeah, true. St Albans, yeah, not too far away.
Yeah, no, Footscray for me is like, that's the heartland. I mean, I'm a passionate Western Bulldogs supporter and lucky enough to be the ambassador of the club. So, you know, when my dad came to Australia in 1970, Footscray was the first place that he called home, the first place he had a job. So, I suppose the most exciting bit of Footscray, it shines a real lens on the multiculturalism of Victoria. I think that all waves of migrants sort of come and settle through Footscray. So you've got this beautiful array of cultures and people and a really multicolored smile everywhere you look, you know, from our Vietnamese immigrants to, you know, Europeans, and now through a heap of Africans and Indians, and everybody was just really congregated in Footscray and made it something special.
We're so lucky in Victoria, aren't we, to have the amount of multicultural dishes available, restaurants, that food scene. I think we take for granted a bit how lucky we are.
Yeah, we definitely do take for granted. And something that we also take for granted is that, you know, we always hear these sort of things about racism and, you know, people pushing against each other. But look, I remember when I was at school growing up in the West, and you had, you know, all of this conflict sort of in Bosnia and Serbia and everything else, and all of that going on, and then it kind of transferred here to Victoria and you'd see it. But now when we filmed in St. Albans and we went to, you know, like a Bosnian coffee shop, and you've got Croatians on one side, Bosnians on the other, and they're all drinking coffee together and celebrating what it is to be living a free life here in Australia. That's what's really inspiring. It's beautiful. You know, it's you don't see that anywhere else. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful. You're right. What are some of your favourite food regions? Aside from your love of the West, what are some of your favourite food regions in Victoria? I'm sure there's a few.
Look, I am a fan of getting in the car and going with the kids down to sort of Box Hill for dumplings. I don't think they've got such amazing sort of, you know, like, there's great. I'm a dumpling fiend, right? Like, I mean, so I love it. But to be honest, I mean, I like a few things. You know, I love my family, I love my sports, and I've always loved my cars. And I've got a couple of cars that I love, and I love jamming the kids into one of the cars on the weekend and driving out to Dalesford, and, you know, sitting out there at the lake house on the deck, and going for a walk down Hepburn Springs, and taking the dog and letting him go for a run. I mean, I love simple stuff. So a bit of scenery, a bit of air, good food, and you know, sort of really wholesome times is what I'm about.
What kind of cars, Shane?
Nothing too special. I'm a Westie, you know, so I've got Monaros and Brock Commodores and stuff like that.
I knew you were going to say that. That's awesome.
Yeah, but I've got one pride and joy, which I remember when I was 21. There was a car. There was a Mercedes that was released, an SL55, which the general manager of the hotel I was working in bought one, and I just turned 21. I just finished my apprenticeship. They were like $380,000 back in 2001. And I've just looked at this thing and said, one day when I make it, I'm going to buy that car. And when I turned 40, cool, geez, a year ago now, I bought that car. Believe me, it wasn't $380,000 anymore.
but it was just a milestone for me. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and is it preciously locked up in the garage along with the others?
Yeah, I mean, it lives in the bedroom and I sleep outside.
I'd love to know what your wife thinks about that.
She's understanding.
Now, filming in Victoria with, you know, a full crew is a far cry from some of the places you travelled to and conditions you worked in while you were filming Spice Journey for SBS, which was a bit of a cult show. That show you took to Iran, Morocco, Lebanon, or the foothills of Lebanon, and you filmed in conflict zones in Syria, even pooped on by a donkey. these are really different. I mean, you're not getting that in Victoria, are you?
Well, not down Lygon Street.
Did the experience of Spice Journey change you as a chef, though? I mean, they're some pretty unique experiences for a boy from Melbourne's West.
It did more than change me as a chef. I mean, it changed me as a person. It changed me as a man. It changed me as a father and as a husband. I mean, I feel I left to go on my first Spice Journey, you know, travel as a really hungry, passionate chef, and I felt like I came back as a well-rounded man. I got to see people who go through so much trouble, so many challenges, but have such a deep-seated love and passion for their heritage, for their culture, for their food culture, for their family, their history, in spite of all the hardship that they face. And it really made me shift my perspective and really appreciate the opportunities and the freedom and liberty that we have here in Australia.
Yeah, that's so true. And you're a pretty busy man at the moment, juggling postcards, but also a Middle East feast on SBS. You're a lucky guy given how hard hit your industry has been in the pandemic. You must consider yourself pretty lucky to be so busy at the moment.
I've always been really blessed. I mean, I've got a great group of people around me that help me and enable me to really dream big. Postcards has been a blessing. Middle East Feast, I never thought that I'd get another chance to do another TV show. That's my third show with SBS. I mean, we did Recipe for Life, Spice Journey, and now Middle East Feast. I'm looking forward to that heading the air. I mean, I think it's on air mid-June or July, so that's going to be something fun. But I have been really lucky. The industry's been really hard, really heavily hit. My restaurants have been decimated. We've tried to hold on to as many staff as we can. We've supported, you know, migrant visa workers that haven't been looked after by the government. We've kept them fully employed. I'll always go and fight for my people because they're always fighting for me.
For people listening, and myself included, who would want to try cooking Middle Eastern food, I'm a bit intimidated. Where do you start?
It's really easy. I mean, you just have to try some new things, right? Like it's not actually this whole nother cuisine that takes a million different ingredients and you need to learn suddenly how to make dumplings and put them in a steamer. I think Asian food's probably harder to cook. Middle Eastern food's homely, it's wholesome, it's a balance of sweet and savory. People say spicy, and I kind of get my back up a bit because most people, when they say spicy, they're talking about heat. I think it's, you know, Middle Eastern food's about fragrance. It's about pronounced flavors. I think you'd start with something as simple as the world famous hummus. You know, like, I mean, there's nothing mm-hmm. more simple than a dish of, you know, chickpeas, garlic, a bit of lemon. That's just world renowned and so bloody good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I'm hungry. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. In a moment, we're going to head back into Chef Shane D'Elia's childhood to the western suburbs of Melbourne and find out just how he went from being the bad kid at school to the maestro of Middle Eastern cuisine in Melbourne.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from the team at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Chef Shane D'Elia, owner of renowned eateries Maha and Biggie Smalls, and he's back on our TV screens on Postcards on Channel 9 and on A Middle Eastern Feast on SBS. He is a busy man. Speaking of being a busy man, Shane, I want to talk about your early life. We said at the end of the last segment that you were the bad kid at school. You're a boy from Melbourne's western suburbs. Where does that anecdote come from, that you were the bad kid from school?
I don't think I'm a bad person. I never thought I was a bad kid, but I was always in trouble. And I think that trouble came from,
naughty kid.
I've got ADHD. I mean, I've had that my whole life. I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't something that was diagnosed. I mean, it wasn't a thing. Mm. So when you're battling with something like that, and I'm not the guy that sits there and bang on about mental health, because I think mental health's obviously real, and I've had my own challenges. But I think a lot of people use it as a cop out for just not being able to face up to the wrong in their life, and use it as a bit of as a scapegoat. And to be honest, that's really sort of like belittling for people who do kind of struggle, right? If you've done wrong in your life, you own it and you move on. You don't just blame something else and look for an excuse. But I found it really hard to focus in school. I found it really hard to connect. My self-esteem was extremely low. And that causes you to rebel, right, and push out. So, I was always known as the bad kid. I was the cousin out of 36 cousins on my dad's side of the family who was always in trouble. I was the guy that was getting suspended from school, the kid that was getting kicked out of class, the guy that would be wagging school in the afternoon just because he just didn't want to be at school because it wasn't understood. So It wasn't that I wanted to cause trouble or punch up kids or do anything stupid like that. It's just that I was finding it really hard to settle in.
Frustrated. Yeah. That's fair enough. And you mentioned all your cousins. You had a huge family. Take us back to those early memories of Sunday lunch with your mum's family and dinner with your grandfather and dad's family. 50 or 60 people for dinner. That's most more than most of us will probably double what most of us would have on Christmas Day. I mean... They're insane memories.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something that's funny. I mean, when I was up until the time I hit secondary school, I thought everybody in Australia was Maltese because in a big family. My dad had, you know, 8 sisters, and they've all got 3 or 4 kids each, and then they've got husbands, and then there's, you know, second cousins, and we grew up in this really tight knit community where. We had everything we needed, and everything was sustained and available within our family unit, and it was really beautiful, right? Like, I mean, it was really beautiful. We had my grandfather was an amazing man. My grandmother was beautiful, strong women in our family, some really good role models, and grew up in this beautiful extended family of 30 odd cousins, but then another 100 second cousins, all within like a couple of blocks.
Wow.
It was really fun. It was really supportive, and it really gave me a great sense of community, and I suppose it gave me the sense of that I'm a part of something bigger, and I need to pull the line.
Yeah.
And being one of the eldest, it was like we were the first generation of the dream being realised. You know, coming to Australia, you know, with the idea of one day having a family, we were those offspring of that dream. So. It's our job now to realise that opportunity and not let the sacrifices of our, you know, grandparents and parents be put to waste.
Yeah, and you're so lucky to have that sense of belonging and, as you say, feeling like something bigger, because a lot of people don't have that. So, yeah, that's wonderful grounding, especially given that your parents were new to the country. Your dad came when he was 17 from Malta with just a couple of dollars and worked at the Dunlop factory. Did he instill the work ethic in you, Shane?
Can I tell you guys are great with your research. Yes, Dad turned 18 on the boat on the way over, and he came by himself. He was sent out here to find a new land, and then, you know, sent back money to bring back the rest of the family over. I mean, it's not a unique story. That happened a lot. But, yeah, look, my dad is one of the most selfless, respectful and honourable people I know. He worked 2 or 3 jobs when we were kids. His only time off was on the weekend, and it was spent with the family, take us to the footy, you know, do some bits and pieces like that. He really wanted to be Australian. Like, my dad got off the boat and decided that he's now Australian. He was going to really assimilate.
Oh, wow.
Didn't speak Maltese at home. Called his son Shane, his other son Dean, his daughter Sarah, wanted to be Australian. And that's something that stuck with us. And he felt that it was his duty to contribute to what Australia could be. He's been given a chance, and now he had to make it work. Yeah. And we've probably taken that work ethic from Dad that, you know, you only get opportunities in life. You don't get anything given to you. So when you get an opportunity, you have to make the most of it.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it and way to learn. When did Mum Doris come into the picture?
Well, Mum was born here. She was born here from migrant parents. None of my mum's parents came from Malta, met here in Australia, married here and had my mum. And I think Mum came into the picture. Dad would have been 18. I think Mum, they would have got married when they were in their early 20s. So I think Dad came and he was, you know, as you did back in those days, you stuck around your own sort of people and found Mum in a Maltese community. And, you know, she's pretty good looking, my mum, so I get my good looks from. So I think he was fitting.
And you've openly said you wouldn't be where you are today without your mum. What sort of influence did she have on you? We know Dad had the great work ethic. Where did Mum come into it for your career?
Mum's a grinder too. Mum works her butt off. You know, I remember there was a tag team sort of thing happening in the early days where sort of Dad would work all day, Mum would work all day at home doing, you know, childcare and bits and pieces. And then Dad would come home, they'd tap gloves, Mum would leave and go work night shift. So, I mean, Mum's a no pushover. And plus she would manage all the money for the house. I remember back in the days, Dad used to get paid cash, right? So he'd come home and put the envelope of cash down once a week. Mum would count out a few bucks, give him some back, and then she'd manage the rest of the money. So I've got the utmost respect for Mum. She's family first always. She's got the biggest heart in the world. I remember even when I was getting, you know, my mind was being ripped apart by why I can't concentrate, why I can't focus, why can't I fit in, why is this all going wrong? Mum was the person that didn't just push me inside and say that I was a, you know, a bad kid. You know, she actually just stood beside me and tried to understand and fought with me every day to, you know, to help get where I am now. So she's the most forgiving person I know, and I probably don't tell her enough that I love her, but she's unbelievable.
Oh, I hope she's listening. That's beautiful. And just on that, Shane, when you talk about not being able to concentrate and how you have ADD, when did you get the diagnosis and how did that change things for you?
Oh, look, it was right at the, like, 11th hour. You know, like, I left school when I was 16, so, like, I left sort of year 11, and it wasn't until sort of when I was, like, 15 and a half that I got diagnosed. And it was just, it was mixed feelings. It was traumatic to think that why didn't this happen earlier? Because as soon as I was diagnosed and medicated and counseled, I went from being a C and D student to an A and a B student, like, overnight.
Wow.
Believe it or not, I'm not stupid.
I think we know that.
I just needed some help, right? So, all the possible, like, the world was my oyster, you know. Suddenly teachers were saying, you know, you don't have to leave school. And I was like, I never felt like I had to leave school. I wanted to leave school. I wanted to be a chef. It wasn't something that I felt like, okay, I can't do this, so I'm going to do that. No, I wanted to be a chef. Even if I had, I was top marking in the school and I could have been a neuroscientist, I still want to be a chef. So, like, it wasn't a fallback. It was hard, but the hardest thing was knowing that I could suddenly get help. And then as soon as I left school, not being considered a student anymore, they pulled all my medication and treatment, and I was left as a sheep amongst the wolves. So it was pretty hard.
And just speaking of wanting to be a chef, I mean, your family was full of electricians, bricklayers, mechanics. Where did chefing come from for you? Where did that food obsession start?
I don't know. I mean, there's no, like, chefs in my family. There's a few generations of bakers, but there's no, like, you know, no one, like, there wasn't, like, one of my uncles was a great chef. Or I think it comes from a love of wanting to connect, and I think people are drawn to things that make them happy, right? People want to be around family environments. People want to be around those memories that make them happy. And I remember growing up with my grandparents and growing up around food and seeing how happy they were, and that sense of giving and selflessness which came through food. And I don't know, like, being a chef in Europe and in the Middle East, it's a respectful job, right? It's not like how it used to be here in Australia. It wasn't just something you did because you couldn't do anything else. Anything with hierarchy for me is something I'm drawn to, because it's a clear passage, right? I know exactly. I start here, I gain respect, I do my job, I get to the next step, and I keep stepping up. I mean, I found it really hard to work in an environment like an office or whatever and thinking, okay, well, how do I actually get to the top? Because there isn't really a straight hierarchy here. It's not just based on how good I am. I don't know how to navigate it. So in the kitchen, I knew what I had to do, just work bloody hard and climb the tree.
Fair enough. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. More with Shane D'Elia in just a moment. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner, and our guest tonight is chef and entrepreneur Shane D'Elia, the man behind Melbourne's Middle Eastern Mecca, Maha and Biggie Smalls, home of one of the best kebabs you're ever likely to eat. You'll also find him on your television, one of the hosts of Postcards on Channel 9 and on a Middle Eastern feast. Now, Shane, before the break, we were talking about your early years and how you got into chefing. But there's some pretty good anecdotes about those early days in terms of your apprenticeship when you started at 17. And that was a pretty tiring time for you, wasn't it? You were getting the train, the V line, to Geelong. Pretty long drives and late nights for you. Were they fun memories or hard working memories of those early days chefing?
No, those early memories are the most important ones, I think. That's the foundation of my career. And I wanted it to be hard. You know, if I get into a fight and it's easy, I mean, you lose motivation. Like, it needed to be hard for me to really sort of give it my all. I mean, I was young, right? So, like, I was living with my mum and dad in the outer west. We were living in Sydenham at the time, and the only train was a V-line. So you'd catch the V-line to Spencer Street and then sort of catch another one to Flinders Street, and then a tram all the way up to Eden on the Park in the other park where I was working. And but the last train home was like, I think, 11 o'clock or 10:30. And, you know, most nights I wouldn't finish before 12 or 1. So my dad would drive into the city every night and wait at the back of the hotel. You know, he'd sneakily stick up the L plates on the windows and fall asleep in the passenger seat. And then I'd jump in the car and drive home and then wake him up. Hey, Dad, we're home. But, he would have to get up that next morning. But he'd have to get up that next morning at like 4:30, 5 o'clock to start work himself. So if you think about the sacrifice and the love that he had to you know, do that for me, you know, I'll never forget that. But then, you know, like you said, going out to Geelong was, you know, big Sunday at my grandparents' house, having Sunday dinner. And then, you know, you have to make the trek out to Geelong for trade school, which you do, you know, 2 week blocks. And no, they were really exciting times. I was a boy in a man's world. I mean, I was 17. Everyone else is, you know, you're walking into a professional world. And it's always pretty daunting for an apprentice coming straight from high school because you don't know what to expect. It's like, you know, you're a primary school kid starting bloody university. So it's everyone's bigger. Everyone knows what they're doing. You run out of steam pretty quick too. Because we used to actually work a full apprenticeship in those days, so you'd actually get to work at, you know, like 9 o'clock, and you wouldn't get home till midnight. So they were big days, and you run out of steam. Like, I remember going home and wanting to give up, and, you know, like saying to mum, I can't do this, and, you know, her standing beside me said, no, you've started this. You said you're going to do it. You just need to keep doing it. And, you know, I would have given up a bunch of times if I didn't have mum and dad right beside me saying, no, keep going. You can do this. You just need to get through this next barrier.
Oh, good on you, mum and dad. I'm always interested to hear too about, because we've had a couple of chefs on the show, and I always find it funny to hear about those really early days in the first kitchens you worked in as to what mistakes you made and how you covered up for it.
Well, there's been a few. what used to happen, I mean, there was things that used to happen in the old days, which I think were fun, but now everyone's a bit scared to have a bit of fun because it can be perceived as bullying. So, like, I mean, there was a day where a couple of the chefs stuck some gelatine sheets in a tray, and gelatin, you know, melts with heat, right? But stuck them in this tray and put them through, like, made me stand on the end of the dishwasher, and they said, Shane, these are microwave filters. They're $1,000 each. You need to stand on the other side of the dishwasher, so make sure they don't fly off inside the dishwasher. When they come out, you need to get them and bring them to me. And I'm sitting there going, no problem, chef. I'll do that, chef. And you stuck them in these little filters and what you thought were filters and just sheets of gelatin. And they go through this roaring hot dishwasher coming out the other side, and they're just like not there, right? They've evaporated. And you have these chefs in the back looking at you, and you're going, oh my God, where's the filters? And you're like pulling this thing apart, and you're shitting yourself. And then suddenly you have to man up to the chef and go, hey, I don't know what I've done. And they're bursting in tears, and you're like, you pricks. But it's like, it's kind of like, I mean, that created a great workplace culture. And we all got along and we tested each other's boundaries, and you had to have a laugh at yourself.
Do you remember what you got paid in the early days?
Oh, it was like $8 something an hour. It was about $8 something before tax. It was peanuts. I think I was getting $260 a week. And when we were, so $260 a week, I mean, the train wasn't cheap because it was a V-line. And then when we were going out to do block release at the Gordon and out in Geelong, I mean, I used to pay for accommodation there. It was like $30 a night. So, but like, and it was they used to rent rooms by the hour. So you can imagine the type of joint it was. For a young 17-year-old kid to be in a room where you could hear people knocking boots next door wasn't fun. I didn't even have enough money to buy my breakfast. Like, I used to have to work in the kitchen of the pub after school so they'd give me a feed in the morning. You know, like, it was pretty tight.
Wow.
And but I wanted to do that. I didn't want to ask for help. I didn't, like, if I asked mum and dad for help, they would have helped. But I don't want to ask for help. Like, I'm my own man, and I need to carve my own destiny.
Good on you. Did you have chefs who you aspired to be like in those days? You know, some of the finer dining chefs?
You know, I I've been asked this a lot, and they're like, oh, who do you look up to, and which are the chefs that you want? I don't want to come across arrogant, but I don't really look up to chefs. I don't sit there and go, oh, wow, I've never been that guy with like sports stars. Oh my God, I've been blown away by that. You know, I can appreciate people and look at it, but no, I wasn't really idolizing anyone. I was trying to work out who I was as a person and as a chef and what I wanted to do. And I just loved cooking. Like, I didn't really aim for the stars. I never wanted to open a restaurant. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just enjoyed being in the kitchen and I enjoyed being amongst a team. I enjoyed being, felt like I was valuable. And I was really loving finally being in an environment where I could excel. You know, like I felt like in a kitchen, there was no distractions. I didn't have time to get distracted. I could fully focus and it was up to my raw ability and what I could contribute to the team. And I really enjoyed that.
Speaking of your raw ability, you started in pubs and pasta shops and hotels. How did you make that leap if you weren't really following in the footsteps of other fine dining sort of chefs? How did you make that leap over to where you are?
Well, I didn't want to start an apprenticeship in just somewhere average. I didn't want to leave school without having a good platform to move forward. So, yeah, my earlier days, I was spending school holidays and weekends and everything else in pubs and pasta shops and anywhere I could find a buck. Like I remember I was pumping petrol on like my, 14 and 9 months or something, you can start working. I was there on the day, like pumping fuel, filling the pie warmer. Like I was that guy, right? Like cleaning the toilet. I was just wrapped to know I was earning money because I wanted to buy my first car and do all those kind of things. And I was at, you know, I was at Vic Roads on my 18th birthday, like there that morning getting my license. So, you know, like how did I make the jump? I mean, I wrote a handwritten letter to every single five-star hotel in Melbourne because I thought I'm going to go for the best. And I wanted to work in a hotel because I knew there was great structure. And back in the 90s, that was the place to be, you know, in a hotel. All the best restaurants are in five stars. And I got knocked back from every single one. Too young, no experience. Well, how are you supposed to bloody get an experience? But, you know, too young and all this kind of stuff. But it was actually just nice to get back a letter on a golden embossed letterhead. I felt pretty special. I eventually found an apprenticeship in a four-star hotel where I'd done some work experience and my mum knew the head chef there. And it was my first crack. And I've always just said, you don't need to push me through the door, just crack it open and I'll do the rest. So I got a crack and I went for it.
And your wife, who you married in 2007, Maha, did she was she a bit freaked out when you decided to call the new restaurant you're opening with George Columbaris after her? Was she honoured?
Well, the fence didn't speak to. It was actually her idea. I thought it would just be a bit of a tax. I thought it would just be a bit of a tax dodge if the ATO come and look for me. I could say it's hers. But no, all jokes aside, I mean, I was thinking about what are we going to call this restaurant, and Maha said to me, "You can always call it Maha. That's a great name." I said to her, "You wish." And then when I started thinking about it, I thought, you know what? It probably
it is.
If anything, she gave me a lot of inspiration to follow my heart with what I wanted to cook. Because before Maha and I got together, I was cooking French food my whole life. And I kind of felt a bit disconnected. And it wasn't until we traveled a bit through the Middle East and started to really get into my heritage and her heritage and realize the similarities and our ancestry that I started to follow a Middle Eastern route and said, you know, if I'm going to cook food, this is the food I want to cook. And so it kind of, and it makes me look good in front of people too, to name the restaurant after my wife.
Very good. Now, you've got two kids, Jada and Jude. Do they love food as much as you, or has it been every parent's struggle in your house to actually get them to eat healthy food?
Like I'm an average guy. My kids are average kids. My son's a chicken nugget master, and you know my daughter's just turned 12, so she's learning what she's you know about herself and going to high school, and she's going through changes and challenging me every second. So I've got beautiful kids, but they're just normal, beautiful, fun loving kids. They haven't got a passion for anything at the moment apart from Fortnite and TikTok, I think. So. It's just you know, like I'm just enjoying watching them grow up, and you know, my little boy loves nothing. Like this morning, it was so nice to wake up. I didn't have to get up at the crack of dawn and run around. And my little boy crawled into my bed, and I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He goes, "Dad, I just want to snuggle." I'm like, "Oh man, like I wish I could stay in bed all day and do that." But no, they're not foodies yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I think every parent, including me, has many a struggle with food and children. But I want to know, this is something I ask, you know, all the chefs that we have on, and in saying that, we haven't had millions, but we've had a few. Is there a night, and is it often that you might just have baked beans on toast?
No, I'm not a baked beans on toast guy. Like, I'm a lot of other stuff. I don't do the whole...
spaghetti.
I'm a dirty pizza from Pizza Hut. I can eat a double quarter pounder with cheese, no problem. You know, HSP, bring it all day. But I don't know about... Yep. I'm not a baked beans on toast guy.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. But it's good to hear that you still, you'll still indulge when necessary.
Oh, yeah.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin... Good. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives and plenty more with Shane D'Elia in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from the team at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner and our guest tonight is Shane D'Elia. He's a lot of things, but just don't call him a celebrity chef. Now, Shane is with me at the moment, of course. I want to know, we touched on this a little bit earlier, Shane, but of course 2020 was such a devastating year for so many industries, but restaurants and food really copped it and still are. How hard was it for you to pivot, to find, you know, a new normal and keep the wheels moving for your business?
It sounds like it was one of those stories. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was a hard time because everything that I'd ever worked for and hoped for suddenly was going to be ripped apart from me and destroyed. And I felt helpless and not knowing what was going to happen. And I didn't know. I questioned myself whether I had enough fight in me to get back in the ring and do it again. I felt like I've been fighting my way through life ever since I've been pushed out into this world. And I was just thinking, can I muster enough strength to do this again? But I made some early decisions about my business. We closed quite early before there was any, you know, government sort of announcements about closures or lockdowns or JobKeeper, which gave me some time to think and plan. And in that time, in that clarity, I realized that I had an opportunity to connect with our customers through a home delivery model, which then turned out to be one of the most exciting businesses that I've ever been involved with, called Providor. And now is a significant part of not just my life, but the Australian culinary scene. I mean, we've single-handedly, and you could quote this by speaking to any of our restaurant partners, I think saved the high-end restaurant scene in Melbourne. I mean, a lot of the restaurants that you know and love would not be here today without the support that Providor offered them during our two lockdowns. And I'm really proud of that because I love these restaurants and they're an integral part of what makes Melbourne beautiful. But now I think that we've got an opportunity to change the world, right? Like, I mean, I dream big. And I think that what Providor does is it connects restaurants to people in a really significant way. In their homes, creating great memories. I mean, my great memories as a child were watching my parents have dinner parties and people over and all that kind of stuff. But life was different and it would be a little bit simpler and people had time to cook. They had time to shop. They actually cooked on a regular occasion, so they knew how to cook. People just don't do that anymore. They're busy. You know, both parents are busy. They're working. They've got kids here, kids there. Family structures are different. You know, so what Providor does is enables people to create beautiful, beautiful memories in their home and let chefs do all the hard work for them. So out of something really hard comes something really beautiful. But I'll always love restaurants and restaurants are where my soul is. And, you know, I still think about the pain and I see it on my staff's face and see some of the people that were victims and casualties of COVID. And, you know, they're now in foreign parts of the world struggling. Where they could be here with us trying to rebuild this beautiful country.
Yeah, there's so many sad stories out of COVID, but as you say, with Providor, a really strong silver lining. And I can imagine, you know, even without lockdown, that business is so strong now that you can continue to evolve it and, you know, and make opportunities out of all sorts of things that are non-COVID related, just having that connection in people's homes.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually given us a great way to speak to new people. And Providor is not a COVID business. It's a real business. And we've actually changed the dining landscape now. So, I mean, people are thinking of new ways to connect, new businesses, new opportunities. The world changes, right? I mean, people say, oh, the world's changed so much. Hang on, the world changes every day. And it's always changed every day. It's just that it's changed dramatically for everyone all at once,
yeah.
Which is kind of a beautiful thing because we actually got the same perspective for once in our life. You know, we're actually moving at the same speed for the first time ever. So it's actually, if we look at the positives, I'm not a stick your head in the sand guy. I don't get ready, I stay ready. So like I think it's time for people to actually lift their head up a bit, get positive. I know, you know, all these lockdowns and bits and pieces is really hard for people to motivate themselves, but there is so much beauty to be seen. We just need to be brave enough to go and get it.
And that is a wonderful way to end the show. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Shane D'Elia.
Thank you. I appreciate being on. Thanks for all the nice words.
And you can catch up with Shane D'Elia on Postcards, Victoria's favourite travel show, of course, on Sundays at 5:30 p.m. on Channel 9 and, of course, on 9 Now. And watch Middle East Feast Thursdays at 8 p.m. on SBS. SBS Food. If you've enjoyed our chat with Shane D'Elia tonight, you can share it with a friend and subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life.
Thanks for listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.